Well, it is a fact, is it
yes,
not?
Yes, it is a fact. Yes, it is.
Should I conceal facts?
Well, I wouldn't conceal them. I just wouldn't be too articulate all the time. No, but you're right.
No, may I also say I come up with what I thought was a rather astute analogy. I figured it out. The Vice President of the United States, if he's running for the presidency, because he is part of an administration, he cannot go out and kind of, and you must forgive me, he cannot go out and knock the administration like other presidential candidates can.
And so, right, there is a certain disadvantage.
And so I think there's a certain amount of strength that is lost when you are running and hoping to become the president if you are the vice president.
Well, Joey, it's a fact that when you are the vice president in an administration, you have a responsibility to that administration. You are under, well, you're a member of a team, and you just don't go out and knock the team. Every team makes a mistake now and then, but you leave it to the opposition to discover that rather than to be projecting it yourself. However, I find there's also some assets in being vice president. You have a knowledge of government, which is, I think, worthwhile. People, it's a pretty big country, and it's a pretty tough job to be president, about the toughest you can get. And if you have some inside information as to the workings of that high office, which you do get as vice president, I think it's helpful. Then, too, there are many rewards to being vice president that are not often portrayed, Joey. The rewards of knowing great people, interesting people, seeing your country, being a part of the development of your country. To be sure, you can't get out and swing as easily and as sometimes as freely on some issues as if you were a senator or a governor or a citizen, lawyer, businessman that seeks office. But that's just the price that you pay, particularly in the field of foreign policy, Joey. I've talked to some of my friends about this, Regis, that I serve on the National Security Council. I'm a member of the President's Cabinet. And when the Vice President speaks, even in a campaign, he has to be careful because he may have his words interpreted as if they are the words of the administration, even though they may be just his own private views. And every man has his private views in the confines of the executive branch of the government or just as a citizen. But you can't always speak just privately. You have to constantly keep in mind that you are a public official and that you are a part of the administration, that your words, while they may not be taken seriously here in the United States, they may be taken very seriously in Moscow or in Hanoi or in Peking or in London or in Paris or someplace else, because it may be interpreted by those people as if it was a plant, so to speak, you know, a probe by the president. Using the vice president to make a particular probe, a particular issue. That's why it gets a little complicated. Sort of.
I imagine it must be very frustrating also, is it not?
Yes, there are times that it's frustrating. I think the thing we have to understand that this office of vice president has very little constitutional background to it, except that you're there in case you're needed. If anything happens to the president, you're the presiding officer of the Senate. Under the Constitution. Other than that, you have no powers. But by precedent and by statute and by experience and tradition, certain activities have grown up with the vice presidency. I, for example, am chairman of the Youth Opportunity Council that works with all of our young people throughout the country, particularly the deprived young people.
I don't know whether you saw, we had the film clip on with Charlton Heston.
Yes,
that's
yes.
The YES program, is
yes,
it not?
That's right. The YES program is youth employment service or
right.
Youth employment opportunities. These are some of the programs that we work with. I chair the space program, all of the astronaut activities. I'm chairman of the program on the marine sciences. We call it oceanography. I am the chairman of the Peace Corps program, that I think one of our finest programs, where we send our talented young men and women overseas to be of help to needy countries and needy people. These are some of the responsibilities you have. The vice presidential office is filled with responsibility, very little authority. Now, when you add that up, you can see some of its awkwardness, some of its complexities. But despite all of that, a lot of people seem to want to be vice president. I've never seen a job that so many people downgraded that so many people wanted, Joey.
I hope you forgive me, Mr. Vice President, but I'm in charge of commercials.
Yes, sir. I was about to give one for myself here.
I'm a victim of protocol. I don't know whether your commercial precedes this one. I think, in all fairness, knowing you rather personally, you will afford me the opportunity of doing my commercial first.
Yes, sir.
And then we'll be listening
right,
to
Regis?
Your commercial.
Right. Yes, sir.
Another thing, Mr. Vice President, it's not necessary to keep asking Regis if it's right. I'm the host. Mr. Vice President, you were about to embark on a commercial, and I think it only fair to give you equal time, so say whatever you like.
Well, Joey, first I just wanted to get my commercial in for California. You asked me early what I thought about California. I love it. I think it's the most exciting part of America. It really is a wonderful place. Everything happens out here, and some of it's happened to me, and I like most everything that's happened. In politics, if you get 50% plus one, you consider it a victory, and I've had better than that in California. Smog, booze, weather, whatever it is, it's all been good. Particularly is it good to be here on your show.
Thank you. Thank you. When Mr. Nixon was on our show last week, he said he thinks, I hope I'm quoting him correctly, it will be a close contest between two men who have been vice presidents. Now, how do you feel about that?
I think that's right. I really do. I believe that this election year will be a toss-up. I don't think you can really make safe predictions, except I'd like to make one that's rather subjective. I don't say it's totally objective. I think that my party can win, the Democratic Party, and if I'm the nominee, I would hope that I can carry that banner on to victory. I never underestimate the opposition. Mr. Nixon is a very talented man. He's a hard campaigner. He's an experienced man. And I think that that we'll have quite a show of it, quite a tussle. By the way, I noticed a sign out here on the dressing rooms that bothered me. Dressing room 8, it said the next president. Was that left over?
So that you won't get too carried away, we also had that up for Pierre Salinger. I guess it may have been left. I don't know. It's the way of a crew, you know, trying to stay down the middle.
You made me feel good. I'll tell you, I came in here feeling real good. I don't know what's going to happen from here on out. But
well, I don't know how to tell you this,
that's
sir.
That's my commercial.
Is it?
Yes.
Dressing room 8
yes.
is my dressing room.
Yes, sir. Well, you want to be king.
Yes. But I'm willing to serve for presidency.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
That's what I've been saying.
I want to say I read your book. Well, I glanced through it. I didn't read it thoroughly. It's there was one particular part in this. I hope I can find it. Your dad.
Yes.
I never, of course, have never met him. But he must have had a great sense of humor. With your permission, I should like to read just this one little paragraph from it. And it says, after Sunday services at the Methodist Church, there would always be a large circle of family and friends at the Humphrey home to sample the cinnamon rolls and talk about everything, particularly politics. Mrs. Humphrey, your mother, occasionally voted Republican.
Yes, she was unreliable.
Yeah, well, that was going to be the end of the
thing.
Wait
a minute. No, don't quit.
No, well, that's the punchline.
Well, see? Let's do it all over.
No, sir. I should demand a caucus. That's what the end of it was anyhow.
Now, what does it say?
Well, it said that, it's funny you ask me what it says. You've got it committed to memory. It says that that your father, Hubert Humphrey Sr., would tell his children, because she had sometimes voted Republican, now you treat your mother with respect. Don't you argue with her and don't ever speak harshly to her because she is my sweetheart. Then he smilingly added, but remember, sometimes she's politically unreliable.
Yes, that's true.
Which was my big laugh.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Joey. Wait till you want me to wear a button.
Joey, forgive me. It was my mother, and I just remember she used to... My father used to tell me many times, he said, you know, I just never know how your mother is going to vote. He said, it's very discouraging. He was county chairman, and he was a local Democratic spokesman, and mother always had a few doubts about the Democratic candidates. And I can remember one time when I went home after my father had passed away, and I had given a very partisan speech, which I used to do about every 2 years in the old hometown. They all came, everybody came, whether they liked it or not. It was just sort of a night out. And
A lot of cinnamon rolls.
Yeah,
right?
You know, and I made it quite an attack, and this is when President Eisenhower was in the White House, and mother liked President Eisenhower, and I pointed out what was really the fact that there had been a very large federal deficit, and I pointed out the amount of it, something like 10 to 11 billions of dollars that was in the recession year of 1958. And when I got home, mother had some of her lady friends in the living room, and she'd already gotten the coffee pot on, and there was cookies and cake and so on, and she called me out in the kitchen, and she says, I'm just ashamed of you. And I said, well, mother, why do you talk like that? And she said, well, the way you talked, said your father would never have tolerated what you said tonight. And I said, well, why is that? She said, well, the way you talked about Mr. Eisenhower. And I said, well, but I didn't say anything untrue about President Eisenhower. She said, you said he had a deficit. She said, now, you know Republicans don't have deficits. There's Democrats that have deficits. Now, what do you think about that?
I think your mother made good cinnamon rolls. We'll do this, and then with your permission, Mr. Vice President, we'll go visit with the audience.
Thank you.
And I'm sure there are many serious questions that the audience would like to ask of you, and I do pride myself on the intelligence of my audience. Mr. Vice President, we're back on the air.
Yes, sir.
We have an audience. Yes, sir.
Mr. Vice President, do you think that America will ever help England into the common market?
Well, I hope so. I believe that this is very desirable. As you know, our country has long favored that policy of England becoming a part of the European common market. In fact, what we call the outer seven, which are associated with Britain, EFTA, becoming a part of the inner six, which is the common market. We think that would be sound policy, but we're not in charge of England. And we're not in charge of Western Europe. We just give it encouragement. I think it'd be good for all of us.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yes, sir.
Where are you from, I ask?
I'm from Glasgow, Scotland. I'm in the British Army.
Hooray!
From the Bronx.
We have time for one more question.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Vice President, do you plan on doing anything about mental health?
Yes, as a matter of fact, both in the field of mental health and mental retardation, Mrs. Humphrey and I have a very keen interest. I don't know whether one of my friends from home is here tonight or not, but Mrs. Joseph, who is my co-chairman of my national campaign, is the president to be, is very active in the Mental Health Association, I believe is to be one of the leading officers, if not the president or the president-elect of the National Mental Health Association. So we're pretty interested in it.
Yes, they need a lot of help.
You bet.
And Joey Bishop, could I sing a song?
I would say on any other night, perhaps.
Okay.
I hope you understand.
All right.
All right? Because it could be perhaps, Please, we have to break away, and then we'll have an entire segment when we come back.
Okay.
So we'll be right back after this word from your local station with the Vice President. Mr. Vice President, we're back on the air. We have a young lady here who would like to ask you a question.
Yes, I have heard several versions, over the radio today that you have released your delegates, and I'd like to know if this is true, and if so, why?
Yes, what I did today was to make an announcement that I wanted every delegate that came to the Democratic National Convention to vote as an individual delegate and to feel perfectly free to cast their vote as they wished. Now, the reason for that is in some delegations in some states, we have what we call the unit rule, where let's say that you have 40 delegates and let's say 35 of them are for myself and 5 for somebody else, I would get all 40 under the unit rule. I have said to those states, release those delegates, let each one vote individually. And if I still get my 35, well and good. If somebody else gets 5, well and good. This way we have what we call an open convention. We don't have anybody that can can bind other delegations. The delegates can vote as they want to. They are not under any kind of compulsion or any kind of rule of majority rule within the delegation. That's it.
I would never forgive myself if I did not acknowledge in the audience the presence of your lovely wife,
yes,
your handsome son, and your gorgeous daughter-in-law.
They're all here, just like you described them.
I was wondering if they'd be kind enough to take a bow. Mrs. Humphrey, Bobby Humphrey, Donna Humphrey. Yes, sir.
Mr. Vice President, as you think about the events in Czechoslovakia since January of this year, does this give you any idea of a way or of a course of action you might take as you think about the United States or the free world and communism, as you watch a communist country struggling on its own without having to be fought for or defended? How does this influence your thinking on the subject?
But first, I must say to you that the situation in Czechoslovakia is so sensitive right now that this goes back to what Joey was asking me a while ago in my position as vice president, and not just as citizen or not as candidate. We must be very, very careful about whatever any of us in government may say about this situation. I can only point out one thing, that behind what we once called the Iron Curtain is no longer an iron curtain. If there is any curtain, it has been eroded, it's been punctured, it has been rusted through. In fact, I think it's becoming very much an open curtain. And there's a movement of emancipation and liberalization going on all over the world, just as we see it right here in the United States, where people are wanting to be themselves, where they want their own identity. And I think it's quite a life story, quite a story here, quite a lesson. The desire for people to be free, it's an amazing thing. It's like a plant that will break through the rock to come into sunlight under the most difficult conditions. Humankind has that same kind of energy, that same kind of thrust. And I think that's what you're really seeing.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Humphrey, what are your views on giving the vote to 18-year-olds?
I am for it. I believe it's very good. May I say that it will require, as you know, a constitutional amendment. And this is one thing that I believe that our young people in the coming months could do a great deal about, asking candidates for Congress whether or not they will support in the Congress a constitutional resolution for an 18-year-old vote. Because that resolution, once passed by both houses of the Congress, must then go to the states for ratification to become a part of the Constitution. And I think this is a mighty good political project for this election year of 1968. I've supported the 18-year-old vote ever since I went to Congress in 1949. I think it's deserved. Young men at age 18 give their lives for their country. And most of them by that time are high school graduates. This generation of young Americans is the best educated generation we've ever had. They've had to take on great responsibilities. I think they ought to have something to say about the decisions of their country. That's what the vote's about.
This gentleman here.
Yes, Vice President Humphrey, how do you feel about the abolishment of the Electoral College?
I think the time is coming when we ought to elect our presidents by popular vote. I believe that's really what we ought to have.
This young lady back here, yes, ma'am.
Since the selection of many of the local delegates is rather confusing, do you feel that we should have a national primary with national regulations for each party?
If we're going to have primaries that are meaningful, young lady, it should be a national primary with national standards, because what you have now in about one-third to one-fourth of the states are state primaries, every one of them different. Some of them, when you win in a primary, that means the delegates really belong to you. You can win a primary in another state and never get a delegate. It's just what they call a popularity contest. You can win a primary in another state and it's what we call preference. They sort of lean your way. Well, that kind of primary law gives a good deal of newspaper coverage. It gives you sort of an impetus as a candidate. It gives you some publicity and some strength. But it doesn't have very much effect, ultimately, upon the decision that's made at the convention or in this selection of a presidential candidate. Therefore, I believe that if you're going to have primaries, number one, there should be national standards for national officers. Secondly, it would be better to have a national primary under very detailed rules and regulations so that we know exactly what we're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Mr. Vice President, as you know, there's been much distress in the minority community throughout the various summers. I was wondering if you might give us some information as to the various programs that is being initiated to alleviate some of the joblessness that's found in the minority community.
Yes, we've had a good deal of unrest in America, just as there has been throughout the world. And by the way, this gives me a moment to say that this unrest or this restlessness that you see in America is not peculiar to the United States. All over the world, young people have this sense of restlessness. It's true behind the Iron Curtain. It's true in countries like the Scandinavian countries. It was obviously true in France recently, as we noticed. It's been true in Britain, Rome, all over the world. Now, what are we trying to do here at home? Well, let me say, first of all, what we're trying to do is not enough. I think the very first thing that we need to understand in the United States that the day of racial discrimination, of racial bigotry, of racial segregation, that day is over. Some people may not know it, but it's over. And we've got to start to practice our so-called legal civil rights rather than just have them on the statute books. And I've called upon our young people in particular to set an example for their elders, to accept people for what they are, to try to indulge and engage in social service to help those who are deprived and who are needy, to go into the ghettos and the inner city areas, to work in the hospitals, to work in remedial education, to work on the playgrounds, to give the kids that haven't had a break, to give them a little extra break. We've got to upgrade the quality of our education in these areas. Many of the young people in America today that are from poor families, white or black, are the victims of educational inequality. And it isn't good enough just to give them equality. You have to give them a little extra dose. It's sort of like a person that's been the victim of starvation. It isn't good enough just to give them a normal diet. You, first of all, have got to give them the extra things that they need to get them up where they can use a normal diet. Extra minerals, extra vitamins, extra chemicals, extra kinds of feeding. Then that person is ready to live under a normal diet. Now, what have we been doing? Manpower training programs, youth opportunity program. Last summer, we were able to find jobs for 1,450,000 needy young people in America between the ages of 16 and 21. We have vast recreation programs underway now. We have remedial educational programs. We have many of these things, Project Upward Bound, work study programs. We have the Project Head Start for the youngsters, the preschool age. But with all of it, my dear friend, may I say there's so much more to do. What we've done thus far is to prove that some things will work. I'll just end up on this note. Most everybody wants to earn his or her own way. People do not want to be relief clients or supplicants. They want to live in self-respect and dignity. The best thing that you can do in a war on poverty is to give a fellow a job, a meaningful job, a person a job. Let people have a piece of the action, so to speak. Let them own a piece of property. In the black community, let them be entrepreneurs. Let them have their bank, a department store that they can own, that they can run. There isn't any reason that some people should just be employees. Other people are owners as well as being employees. And when we get this kind of an America, we're going to have much less restlessness, much less. Then people are going to feel they have a country that belongs to them.
We have time for just one more question. Yes, sir.
Recently in South Vietnam, the runner-up in last year's election was jailed because he said things that the Saigon government considered demoralizing to the war effort. How do you feel about this?
Well, I've had that question asked before. I really do not know what the evidence is there, for quite frankly. And I don't think it's good for any of us to stand in judgment until we really know what evidence a country or a government might have on another particular citizen. This is a citizen of South Vietnam. I venture to say that in this audience, that if we polled it, very few people would know who the gentleman was, because we're not quite that familiar with all of the details. I happen to believe that one of the requirements of a representative government is due process of law. And I would hope that this gentleman, Mr. Zhu, will get some due process of law. I'm not sure that he will, but I hope that he shall. But I don't know what the evidence is, and I don't want to stand in judgment.
Mr. Vice President, I know that Mrs. Humphrey and your son and daughter-in-law are hungry. I'm not going to detain you. I thank you, first of all, for having given up your dinner date to come spend some time with us. But I must ask you, how does a presidential candidate relax? Now, that must be awfully strenuous, campaigning. There were, I think, three television shows that you've done. You were down, I believe, in the Watts area.
Yes, sir.
This morning.
Yes.
What do you do for relaxation?
Well, Joey, I like to live as normal life as possible. When I get a chance, we go out to our home in Waverly, Minnesota, where we have a lovely lake home. I like to boat. I like to swim. I like to hike. I like baseball. I watch the baseball games on television when I can't go to them, and I try to get to one once in a while. That's one of my favorite sports. I think it's a great sport. I like football. I'm a spectator for sports as well as a sort of a junior league participant. Just get a big kick out of unwinding, so to speak, with my family and with my friends.
You also, I understand, and this is from our underground spy system, quite a dancer.
Oh, I do like to swing a bit, I want to say. As a matter of fact, I like it very, very much.
Now, I must say that, and you must forgive me, in our age bracket, swinging could very well be a foxtrot or a waltz.
Oh, I'm way beyond that. I've come a long way since then.
The fugue and all that?
Well, in a sort of my own inimitable style. It doesn't always fit the pattern, but I get a big bounce out of it, and I mean a bounce.
Do you like the music that the kids are?
Oh, I love it. In fact, I love all kinds of music, everything from classical music to jazz, to what the kids are playing now and what they respond to. I really do. I get a real good lift out of it and enjoy it. Our whole family does, as a matter of fact. Mrs. Humphrey, Muriel, plays the piano and plays it pretty well, and our kids dance, and they bring all the gang out to the house, and let me tell you, once in a while, my wife will say, "Now, that's enough. You don't need to look anymore. Just come on inside." That is when some of those younger numbers come out there. But I really enjoy it.
Mr. Vice President, before you leave, I would like to take another minute of your time and ask you something. Now, I've had a kind of a campaign here. It seems like for the past few years, we have been preaching, you know, love.
Yes.
You see kids walking around, extending two fingers, indicating love. And I've kind of inaugurated a new policy, maybe not a new philosophy, but a new policy. And I've always felt that we have to start with kindness first. I said, as an example, I said, if I'm out on the highway and it's raining and I've got a flat tire, don't go by and say, "I love you," and just keep going, you know. Be a little kind and stop and help me with my flat tire. And then if you don't want to love me afterward, that's fine too.
Right.
Now, don't you think there is an absence of kindness in our country today, I read in your book, for example, when someone had a child in your neighborhood,
yes,
everyone celebrated. When someone was ill, everybody pitched in.
Yes.
And I said on this particular show one night, I said, we all know what's going on, but somehow we don't seem to care enough to want to help. And yet this one paragraph in your book,
yes,
gave me to believe that in your particular neighborhood, as in my particular neighborhood in South Philadelphia, people cared enough. If they heard someone was not well, they cared enough. Do you find it kind of disappearing?
I think the visible evidence of it is somewhat less, Joey. I believe that people are caught up in everything that's so big today that they're not quite sure of just who are their friends and with whom they should identify. I think this is part of what the restlessness in America is about today. I think this is particularly true with young people. They feel that the government's big, too big, the system is too big, too impersonal, the university is really very big and too impersonal, and they're really trying some way or another to remind us, look, here I am, let's talk person to person. They want to, as they put it, a dialogue, individual to individual. But there's a basic goodness in the American people, Joey. If I didn't believe that, I'd get out of politics in 5 minutes. I know that there is a basic sense of compassion and decency and goodness in the American people, and that's kindness. We just have to find ways to tap that. And every day there are some of us that see these little acts of kindness. But I tend to agree with you that it isn't good enough just to put up the symbol of love, so to speak, but to act the deeds of kindness. And the one thing that I would say, if I can give my commercial on this program, is that the poison that kills is the poison of hate. And if we can somehow rid ourselves of this toxin of hate, of bitterness, I think this country is going to be able to take care of any problem that confronts it. It does. You just consume yourself and all your energy with bitterness and hate. And if you find ways to express that same energy with compassion and kindness and understanding and patience, we're going to overcome any problem that we have, Joe.